with gusts as high as 45 miles per hour overnight. Tomorrow, scattered snow showers. Throughout the afternoon, areas of blowing snow as well, increasing clouds with a high near 36. We'll see west winds of 20 to 30 miles per hour, decreasing to 10 to 20 miles per hour in the afternoon, although we could see gusts as high as 45 miles per hour for Saturday. Sunday so far is looking mostly sunny with a high near 31. Coming up, Kodiak's Aleutic Museum announces its Volunteer of the Year. And Yuzinki, after a long wait, has a new hydropower system. That's after NPR headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The president of Ukraine is urging his countrymen and women to remain strong as their nation enters a second year of conflict against Russian military invaders. Heard through a BBC interpreter, a defiant Volodymyr Zelensky says he is certain Ukraine will be victorious.
We will defeat all threats. Shelling, bombs, missiles, kamikaze drones, blackouts, cold. We are stronger than all of this.
National pride rang out in Kyiv. The bells of St. Michael's Cathedral chimed at midnight as Ukrainians prayed for survivors as well as the fallen and are reminded that after a year of war, Ukraine still stands. The U.S. and its allies have issued a raft of new sanctions against Russian individuals and companies. NPR's Jackie Northam reports the list also includes dozens of people and organizations helping Russia evade sanctions.
The Treasury Department calls this its most significant sanctions action to date to retaliate against the Kremlin for its war in Ukraine. It targets more than 200 Russian companies and individuals, including many governors. It adds the country's metal and mining sectors and more than a dozen financial institutions to the sanctions roster, as well as defense and technology companies supplying military hardware. In addition, the U.S. and its allies also blacklist scores of individuals and companies from countries such as China, Switzerland, and the United Arab Emirates that are helping Russia evade current sanctions. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Washington.
The Commerce Department is reporting higher than expected inflation last month. NPR Scott Horsley has more on that.
The Commerce Department's inflation yardstick, which is closely watched by the Federal Reserve, shows January prices were up 5.4% from a year ago. Excluding food and energy prices, so-called core inflation was 4.7%. Prices rose 0.6% between December and January. Rising prices don't appear to be turning off shoppers. Personal spending jumped 1.8% last month, outpacing the gain in personal income. Americans spent more on cars, restaurant meals, and pharmaceuticals. The prospect of lingering inflation is once again pushing up mortgage rates. The average rate on a 30-year home loan is now 6.5%, the highest in 3 months. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Rare winter storms continue to wreak havoc in the Midwest and West. In Southern California, as blizzard warnings took effect, freeways were shut down. The National Weather Service's local weather alert tweeted warnings of possible waterspouts and small tornadoes because of the storms. Much of Portland, Oregon remained shut down today because of icy roads. Michigan at one point reported more than 800,000 homes and businesses without power because of this week's storms. You're listening to NPR News. Former South Carolina attorney Alec Murdaugh was back on the witness stand for a second day in his trial for double murders. The lead prosecutor cross-examined the defendant charged with killing his wife and son in 2021. Murdaugh testified he had an opioid addiction. He also said he cooperated with investigators, except when it came to telling them the truth about the last time he saw his wife and son alive. Murdaugh maintains he was not involved in their deaths and has pleaded not guilty. The prosecution argues Murdaugh killed members of his family to generate public sympathy and distract from serious financial crimes for which he is also facing charges. The producers of the movie Rust have announced a settlement with New Mexico's Occupational Health and Safety Bureau. NPR's Mandalit del Barco reports the case came after the shooting death of the movie's cinematographer, Helena Hutchins.
The producers say they've agreed to pay New Mexico's OSHA $100,000 for failing to comply with workplace safety violations that resulted in Hutchins' death. An attorney for the Rust Movie Productions says the penalty was reduced and the agreement still needs to be approved. The announcement comes a day after producer-actor Alec Baldwin pleaded not guilty to involuntary manslaughter. He was charged with shooting Hutchins during a rehearsal on the set of the Western movie. Hutchins' family is suing Baldwin and others involved with the production. Meanwhile, filming is set to resume in Montana this spring. Mandalit del Barco, NPR News.
Turning to Wall Street, U.S. stocks end the day lower. The Nasdaq closed down more than 1.5%. The Dow is down more than 1%. S&P down 1%. It's NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor, llama al 907-481-2400.
For KMXT, I'm Kirsten Dobrath. Earlier this month, the Aleutic Museum announced Chris Woolley as its Volunteer of the Year for his research about children who were taken from the Kodiak Archipelago and sent to boarding schools in the lower 48. KMXT's Brian Venwa reports.
The Aleutic Museum's Volunteer of the Year Award recognizes folks who spend time working on projects with the museum. This year's award went to Kodiak resident Chris Woolley.
When this project for finding information about family members from Woody Island came up, he was somebody that we approached.
That's Derek Shia, the Aleutic Language and Living Culture Manager for the Aleutic Museum, talking about Woolley. Shia says that when they decided to work on the Carlisle Repatriation Project, Woolley was one of the first folks on their radar. The museum undertook the research project to find and contact descendants of indigenous children taken from Aleutic lands to a boarding school in Pennsylvania to repatriate their remains. Woolley was asked to be part of the project thanks to his extensive knowledge of Woody Island families in particular. Woolley has worked as an archaeologist and anthropologist around Alaska for over 40 years and says that knowledge has been instrumental to the project.
Yeah, I've been involved at the Aleutic Museum for many years. I had done work on Woody Island and ended up working to get a good chunk of that west side of Woody Island on the National Register of Historic Places. So had been pretty familiar with the records from that era, basically the late 1800s into the early 1900s.
He says while he's grateful for the award, he was just one part of the research team.
Well, it was mixed emotions. I was really happy, but I want to share it with the others in the group that are doing just as much work as I am.
Part of his work with the Carlisle Repatriation Project included contacting the family of Anastasia Ashawak, whose remains were brought back to the village Old Harbor for reburial in her family's plot last year. But the work hasn't ended. He and his team are still looking into contacting descendants of Periscovia Friendoff, another native girl taken from Woody Island. She was taken to what was called the Outing Program in Pennsylvania, where children were sent to be acculturated to Western norms and gender roles. Woolley says it's been more difficult to find records of Periscovia than it was for Anastasia.
We're trying to kind of track down any reference to Periscovia, who had spent 4 years in that outing program with families in Pennsylvania. Not clear if there's any relatives. It doesn't sound like there are, but her story is a bit of an enigma, and we're trying to work through it.
In recognition of Woolley's work, the museum has issued him a plaque as well as recognition on their website. In Kodiak, I'm Brian Venwa.
The American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska sued the State Department of Corrections yesterday over a rights issue affecting certain people in state custody. The specific legal matter is a bit down in the weeds, but has big impacts on how prepared someone is for life outside of prison. Alaska Public Media's Jeremy Shea reports.
When someone serves time in Alaska's prisons, they'll hit certain milestones as they approach their release date. And they'll become eligible for things like work release, electronic monitoring, and rehab programs. Parole boards often grant earlier release dates, but the ACLU says the Department of Corrections won't recognize those new dates for eligibility purposes for these programs.
They are crucial to helping people be able to readjust to our communities and to be successful once they're released.
That's ACLU Legal Director Ruth Botstein speaking at a news conference on Thursday. The ACLU is representing four men caught up in the technicality: Jace Frankson, Jeffrey Mathis, Jonathan Walker, and Sababu Hadari. They've each served more than 20 years of their decades-long sentences and were each granted parole, moving their release dates up. But the corrections department has told them that, based on their original release dates, they are ineligible for the transition programs. ACLU prison investigator Jacqueline Shepherd recounted a conversation she had with one of the men.
I've been behind bars my entire adult life. I have no idea how to open a bank account. I don't know how to use a computer. And I've never really had an apartment or adult responsibility. I can't qualify for any community-based programs that would help me transition slowly into society. I feel like they're purposefully setting me up to fail.
Of the named plaintiffs, Frankson has the earliest release date set for August 9th, 2024. Botstein called the department's interpretation of the eligibility rules irrational and arbitrary. The organization is asking the court to assert that the Department of Corrections is violating due process and equal protection rights, and to order the department to give the plaintiffs and others like them access to transition programs. A spokesperson for the department said in an email late Thursday morning that she was not yet aware of the lawsuit. She forwarded a request for comment to the State Department of Law, which has not yet responded, though the state generally does not comment on current litigation. The ACLU says the state has 40 days to respond in court. In Anchorage, I'm Jeremy Shea.
In other news, in April, the State Division of Public Assistance will begin the years-long process of reviewing every Medicaid recipient in the state. All 263,000 Alaskans who receive Medicaid have been guaranteed coverage over the last 3 years of the statewide COVID-19 public health emergency. Now the division has to resume its usual checks to make sure people still qualify while it manages a backlog of food stamps and other public assistance applications. Alaska turned in a plan to the federal government, but it is one of only 9 states without a publicly posted plan for how it will wind down from the public health emergency. It does have an FAQ and some information on its website. Deb Etheridge is the director of the Division of Public Assistance. She took over leadership with the division last month in the midst of the backlog. She says the state doesn't want anyone to lose health coverage.
And for the individuals who will be transitioning off of our state Medicaid program, we're working with the federal marketplace with the Division of Insurance to ensure that they have options for health insurance.
Most of the recertification work falls on the eligibility staff, who will determine if individuals still qualify for federal assistance. But there is something Alaskans can do to prepare: make sure their addresses are up to date with the state. Notifications about when and how to reapply for Medicaid will arrive by mail, and Etheridge says that checking and reading the mail will help speed the process. Updating an address does require a call to the division's virtual contact center, which has frustrated public assistance recipients with long wait times over the past few months. But Etheridge says the division will be training 75 new contract workers to answer the phones in the coming weeks, which should significantly lessen wait times. Jared Kosin, the president of the state's Hospital and Nursing Association, called it, quote, a major insurance event. He said that people tend to fall off the Medicare rolls when there's a change that requires action from the consumer.
Outreach and kind of methodical planning and execution are going to be really important, because it can be really disruptive to have a lot of people drop off of Medicaid.
Officials say some reapplications will be processed automatically, but others will need to be done manually by the same eligibility workers that are processing a months-long backlog of food stamps. But there's a key difference between the food stamp applications. People stopped getting food stamps with that backlog. Etheridge says that won't happen with Medicaid recertifications. Alaskans who no longer qualify for care will have 30 to 60 days for appeals. The department hasn't yet released a public plan for what will happen after that. And earlier this month, the state joined a lawsuit that could pull the abortion pill from shelves. If it succeeds, doctors and advocates say it will further limit rural Alaskans' access to reproductive health care. KTOO's Claire Strempel has the story.
Bristel Larson lives in Dillingham. 20 years ago, she became pregnant.
I was very early on in my pregnancy and knew in my heart that I was not going to be a mom.
She worked seasonal jobs that required physical labor, jobs she couldn't manage pregnant or with an infant. She chose to have an abortion. She had to travel to Anchorage, one of only 3 cities in the state that offers them. She said a medical abortion, known as the abortion pill, wasn't an option for her at that time because she didn't live close enough to Anchorage. Her doctor didn't want to send her hundreds of miles back to Dillingham where they couldn't check on her. But she said she could see some benefits.
I think it might have been less traumatic for physically and not having to go through the, you know, putting on the gown and going through the whole rigmarole.
That was almost 20 years ago, but the trip would be the same today. More than a quarter of people who seek abortions in Alaska travel more than 30 miles for care, according to Planned Parenthood. Abortion is legal in Alaska, but doctors and advocates say it's not equitable or accessible because of the state's geography and large rural population. And some say the lawsuit the state joined could limit access even further. Doctors say mifepristone is the most effective abortion pill on the market. The lawsuit would make sure it was no longer available. Dr. Robin Holmes is a primary care provider in Homer. She's concerned about the direction the legal system is moving when it comes to medicine.
The overall implication is that politicians took away physicians' rights to prescribe medications that are safe and effective for purely political reasons.
The clinic where Holmes works does not provide abortions or prescribe abortion pills. It offers sexual and reproduction care and education for people of all income levels in the southern part of the Kenai Peninsula. Abortion is protected in the state's constitution through the right to privacy, but Holmes said that it can be hard to find care that feels private in small towns in Alaska.
Alaskans are already so limited in their access to even getting reproductive health care as far as STI screenings or long-acting contraceptive options. What we don't need is to have another political imposition to our health care access.
Rose O'Hara Jolly is the director of Planned Parenthood Alliance Advocates in Alaska.
This case is baseless. There is no reason from a science standpoint, from a healthcare standpoint. It is simply about restricting access to abortion, even in states where abortion is still legal.
A statement from Alaska Attorney General Treg Taylor says he joined the lawsuit because the federal government allows the pill to be prescribed by mail, which means even people in states where abortion is illegal can get it. That's not the way most Alaskans get it. Planned Parenthood is the state's main prescriber, and it only does so in person. But the lawsuit would still make the pill unavailable in the state. If the lawsuit is successful, O'Hara Jolly said Planned Parenthood will still prescribe abortion pills, but it will have to use a slightly less effective drug if mifepristone is no longer legal.
Abortion will still be safe and legal in Alaska. We just will have one less method.
A decision in the case is expected as soon as the end of this week. With reporting from Izzy Ross in Dillingham, I'm Claire Strempel in Juneau.
The village of Uzinki on the Kodiak Archipelago recently replaced its hydropower system, but it's taken the village more than 2 years to get there, and it comes as more remote communities in Alaska are eyeing their own transition to renewables. KMXT has this report. As of late last month, the village of Uzinki has a new hydropower system that provides the bulk of energy for the village of 130 people. But getting there wasn't easy. The story starts back in the 1980s. That's when the village's hydropower system was first installed. It worked, but it had issues and was only running at about 50% of its overall capacity. And then, in November of 2019, it failed altogether, a month after Elijah Jackson was sworn in as mayor. He says the city immediately started securing grants to fix the system.
And then COVID came and just stopped everything.
Parts were hard to find because of supply chain issues, and it was nearly impossible to fly people into the village because of the pandemic. The scope of the project also changed and grew as time went on, and more people and equipment were needed for the ballooning scale of the work. Jackson says in the midst of the project, the plant's newly installed main water line called a penstock failed. It's the main water line for the whole system.
And this line didn't last 2 years. It broke down in a year and a half. 6 months out of our warranty.
Uzinki had secured a $2.8 million grant to install the penstock, but it also took out a 40-year loan with the U.S. Department of Agriculture for more than $460,000 for that specific part. Tyler Cornelis is the Economic Development and Environmental Programs Manager at the Kodiak Area Native Association. He helped with the grant hunting process for Yuzinki's hydropower system and agrees that timing was a big hurdle.
There's supply chain challenges. There's engineers that are overworked and under available in the state. So just lining up the right people to get the job done has been a challenge.
The village had to use diesel generators to keep the lights on, but Jackson says they were hemorrhaging money to keep up with the fuel bills. Jackson says they owe more than $100,000 to the Yuzinki Native Corporation for fuel payments. Jackson's been reluctant to raise rates on residents. He says a short-term fix has been for staff to take on 3 to 4 jobs to cut costs. In his case, that means he's also the village public safety officer, and a lot of sleepless nights in the meantime.
I have contractors and state employees calling me evenings, weekends, you know, just nonstop holidays about, oh, we're coming in, this is happening, or you guys need to fill this out. Or, I mean, it's always something. And so just to be doing it this long and actually have next to no results is tough. It's like running and just pushing a wall that's not moving nonstop, you know.
According to the U.S. Department of Energy, roughly 140,000 Alaskans depend on isolated electric grids, and those power sources typically come from burning fossil fuels. But that's changing, thanks in part to an influx in federal funds from the bipartisan infrastructure law that incentivizes renewables.
There's going to be a lot more opportunities for rural Alaskan communities to take advantage of local renewable energy resources.
Chris Rose is the executive director of Renewable Energy Alaska Project, which promotes the development of renewable energy in the state. He says Alaska is positioned to be an international leader to provide developing parts of the world a model to use as more remote communities develop their own renewable microgrids. The city of Kodiak, for example, is almost entirely reliant on renewable energy for its electricity. But Rose says designing a self-contained power system for a small community that's off the road system, like Yuzinki, is challenging. So is the upkeep.
It's not just money that we have to have. We need to, you know, we need project managers that are trusted and can help a community.
The most successful projects typically have what he calls a local energy champion. That's someone in the community who's keeping an eye on training opportunities for staff to maintain the project, or someone who understands how to tap into programs to bring down rates for residents. And just as important, according to Rose, is connecting with other communities that have had similar growing pains.
Knowledge sharing is really important. There's really no reason why every community has to go through this for the first time and have the same kind of issues that maybe another community already learned from.
Yuzinki didn't quite have the luxury to plan for all of this since its energy system failed suddenly right before the pandemic. But Jackson says he's reluctantly taken on the role of energy champion since then.
I love challenges. You know, I also didn't know when I was elected mayor, it makes you utility manager here too. So it's been a huge learning curve, and I definitely had no idea what to do during a pandemic. Very humbling experience this has been. So
he says he hasn't found any grants to help chisel away at the village's outstanding fuel bills, but he's hoping lower energy rates will help pay off the debt. And most importantly, give people a reason to stay in the village long term. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobrath.
A resurgence in inflation. I'm Nova Safo with the Marketplace Minute. Consumer prices had been on the decline for months, but January saw a reversal in the Federal Reserve's preferred inflation gauge. On an annual basis, prices rose 5.4%, slightly faster than in December. A big part of the picture in January was growth in consumer spending. After a downturn in December, spending rose almost 2% month over month. That could have been driven in part by a cost of living adjustment for Social Security recipients. Seniors started getting bigger checks last month. On the one-year anniversary of Russia's invasion, Ukraine today took a step to boost its exports by sea. It will set up a $500 million insurance fund for civilian vessels at its ports. I'm Nova Safo with the Marketplace Minute.
Marketplace Minute is supported by JLL, shaping the future of real estate for a better world.
Hello, Kodiak, and welcome to the February 24th edition of Island Byways. I'm Pam Foreman. It sure feels like we've turned a corner in terms of daylight, doesn't it? enough daylight after work for a walk or a ski or even a paddle. That feels pretty darn good, almost like spring. Most of us will admit it's probably a little too early to count winter out just yet, but the added daylight sure is welcome. Looking toward the night sky, keep your eyes open for aurora activity in the coming days. There's some big sunspot activity happening and a huge hole in the sun's atmosphere, creating a solar wind that could hit Earth around the early part of next week. Those solar storms produce the right conditions for aurora. So keep your eyes peeled at night, and if you really want to view them, get away from city lights as much as you can. Let your eyes adjust to the darkness and look toward the north. Jupiter and Venus are shining brightly in the western sky just after sunset right now. Venus is a little lower in the sky and a bit brighter than Jupiter. They are beauties shining in the night sky. Back here on Terra Firma, my nights are currently tied up working on a community theater production of Chicago. Community theater is a wonderful thing, and I encourage everyone to give theater a try. Whether you want to be on stage acting, dancing, singing, or all of the above, or you want to work the backstage arena using carpentry, painting, lighting, audio, or sewing skills, there is something for everyone to do. You get to be part of a creative team where no idea is really a bad one and imagination is rewarded. Where you'll hear words like, "We can do that. We just have to figure out how." Give it a try next time you hear the Arts Council or Fairwind Players is putting on a production. I'll bet you won't regret it. And that's it for Island Byways this week. Have fun and stay safe out there. Thanks for listening.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Well, it is Friday, February 24th. The year is 2023. Sunrise today was at 8:17 a.m. Sunset tonight will be 6:29 p.m. That's 10 hours and 13 minutes of daylight, gain of 4 minutes and 56 seconds. Sunrise tomorrow will be 8:14 a.m. Record high for today was 54 degrees in 1936. Record low was -4 in 1975. Looking at our marine weather coming up from Armid Island to Sikkenak, there's a gale warning tonight and Saturday. Today, northwest winds of 30 knots, seas to 9 feet. Tonight, west winds of 40 knots, seas to 11 feet. And for tomorrow, northwest winds of 40 knots, becoming west winds of 30 knots in the afternoon and seas to 12 feet. For the Shelikof, there's a gale warning tonight. Today, west winds of 25 knots with seas to 6 feet. And tonight, west winds of 35 knots, seas to 8 feet with freezing spray. A few minutes for community announcements. There is a Borough Assembly special meeting. That's Monday, February 27th at 6:30 p.m. in the Assembly Chambers. On the agenda, consideration of appointment or the process for appointing a borough manager. That is 6:30 p.m. on Monday. And the Coast Guard Marine Safety Office downtown has moved. Their new location is 5211 West Reznov Drive across from Anton Larson Road. Their phone number will remain the same, though. That's 907-486-5918. The Historic Preservation Commission will hold a meeting on Tuesday, February 28th at 12 p.m. in the Kodiak Public Library Multipurpose Room. The meeting is open to the public. Agendas and meeting packets are available online. That's at the City of Kodiak's website. To request paper copies of the packet or for additional information, call the Kodiak Historical Society. Their number is 486-5920. And the local Fish and Game Advisory Committee will hold a public meeting at 5:30 p.m. on February 28th. That's Tuesday at the Fish and Game Building on Near Island. The Advisory Committee will be discussing proposals to the Board of Game, especially the ones for Kodiak. The meeting is open to the public and is an opportunity to voice your concerns and suggestions. For more information and to contact the Board of Game directly, go to boardofgame.adfg.alaska.gov.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT three times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the Midday Report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets,
You can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.
Spotlight is brought to you in part by Creighton Chiropractic Clinic, offering chiropractic care and massage therapy in a peaceful, relaxing, and beautiful atmosphere. Located at 814 Resinoff Drive across from the high school, 487-9798, Creighton Chiropractic Clinic. We got your back.